Just under 2,400 cases of COVID-19 were reported yesterday. On the same day, the government announced that the economy will fully reopen on Friday. Masks will still have to be worn, and any indoor events, including in restaurants, bars and nightclubs, will only be open to vaccinated people. Live music venues and theatres can be seated only. Latest figures show 13 intensive care beds available across the country. 473 people are in hospital with COVID. 74 of them are in intensive care. We are joined now by Dr. Coleman O'Loughlin, who is president of the Intensive Care Society of Ireland. Dr. O'Loughlin, good morning. You're welcome.
Good morning, Audrey.
Can ICU cope at the moment?
Yes, I think that's a simple answer. At the moment, the numbers are increasing, but as things stand, we're able to cope with the numbers coming through from the emergency departments into the wards and into the ICU, and at the same time cope with non-COVID activity in the hospital. But I suppose our concerns arise around the projections, and the projections that were talked about a lot yesterday were up to 1,000 patients in hospital and 150 in ICU over the next couple of weeks and months, and that is quite concerning, because that's going to be very difficult to cope with in the setting of this very, you know, increased capacity across the, or increased activity across all hospital levels that's been going on over many months. So we're looking at a situation where you said 74 beds today. This day last year there was 34 beds. So we're going into this not in the best position. We're talking about a cohort of patients that when they come into the intensive care are very, very, very sick and stay a very, very long time. Not all of them will survive, and those who do survive are very unwell for a significant period afterwards. So it's a huge challenge, and one that I suppose we'd hoped we wouldn't have to face into again, but the numbers are there and it's happening. Transmission in the community is much higher than we'd like, and that will, and it always has done, that relationship between high transmission in the community relating into hospital admissions and into ICU has always been there, and that's going to happen. There's no getting away from that.
And even if the numbers don't rise to the levels projected yesterday, which you referred to yesterday, how high can they go without the system getting into serious trouble?
I mean, it's very difficult, because it's very difficult to project that type of scenario. Each time we face into this, you know, the society is different. The first time we had complete lockdown, hospitals were empty, apart from COVID activity. The second wave we had after Christmas, there was very little vaccination happening. So the environment we were operating in is very different. What's concerning at the moment, I suppose, is that just general hospital activity is extremely, extremely busy. I mean, you know, RED over the summer has seen attendances higher than it's ever seen for months and months in a row, which it's never seen before, and this is during the summer. So that's kind of leading to a kind of very tight system, and we're trying to figure out how we can squeeze in emergency care alongside all this COVID work as well. I don't have an answer for that, what that number is. Each hospital will have a different point at which it will have to kind of consider how it runs as a hospital in terms of coping with increased COVID activity. I suppose the word that's used a lot is a surge activation. So each hospital is different in that aspect, but it's a place no one wants to get to. Surge is something that we really, really, really want to avoid.
Well, I was going to say, no one's using surge yet, are they?
No, not in the classic sense. There are ICUs that have had to change the way they work. Not every ICU is the same. Some will have divided up into two different ICUs, one for COVID and one for non-COVID. As an example of a difference in that is the ICU in the Mater, where we have single rooms and we have COVID alongside non-COVID in the same ICU. So in the classic sense, surge hasn't been activated. And it's something, as I said, that we're really, really nervous about, because, and it's not maybe that well appreciated nationally, that surge isn't something that just exists. There's no great cavalry around the corner that you can call on to make this happen. As a colleague of mine said, that to surge in ICU, you have to de-surge somewhere else in the hospital. So you have to close aspects of the hospital, ask those staff to move across into an area they're not familiar with, and look after very, very sick patients. And as I said, the hospital is so busy anyway, no one can identify any areas in the hospital that you can do that easily to. And again, it looks like, again, that if it does happen, it'll be elective surgery that'll probably take the biggest brunt. And we're talking about an environment of you know, phenomenal waiting lists and huge amount of numbers that's been well publicised on waiting lists. So, you know, the last thing we want to do is add to those waiting lists by deferring elective surgery again. But you know, that's the kind of the low-hanging fruit and how we do activate surgery. So it's something we're really, really, really reluctant to do.
Yeah.
But if we have to, we will.
It's probably not helpful for me to say that perhaps at any point over the past 20 years, we could have said there are only 13 ICU beds available around the country and the system didn't collapse. But is this different? Are you operating in a different league at this point?
I think so. I mean, you know, it's a very complex system how the ICU works and what's available. For example, the ICU in the Mater is full at the moment, but yet we have patients who will move into ICU C and the patients move out, so the beds don't get cold. I mean, they've been turned around all the time, but it's hard to describe what an available ICU bed is all the time. Most ICUs don't have empty beds. They don't have a bed waiting for a patient to come in. What they will have is someone on the far side of an illness and are getting towards being suitable for ward transfer, and then when the next sick patient comes, that transfer happens. So that kind of level of oversight in the ICU is very difficult to get. But we've always operated on a capacity problem where we're occupancy in ICU has been over 100% in a lot of the big ICUs in the hospital for many, many years. And that's been advertised, it's been brought to the attention of the HSE for many years. And they're aware of that, and I suppose plans are afoot to try and increase ICU capacity. But unfortunately, and I think people will appreciate that it doesn't happen that easily. You need real estate, you need new builds, you need new areas to put those ICU beds in, because every nook and cranny of every hospital is being utilised now. There's no space to put that. So that requires all those problems of design and tender and planning permission and building. And all that takes time. So it is a difficult process. And we are operating, I suppose, at a level that we've never operated before in terms of asking our staff to, push the boat out even further than they have done for many years. We're operating in huge levels of overtime, huge amount of goodwill, which is thankfully still there, but it's very different than what we're used to.
Yeah, and just under 2,400 cases of COVID announced yesterday. Why do you think the cases are rising?
Look, I think it's disheartening to see that. I think that applies to everybody, not just us working in the hospital sector. I mean, I'm not entirely sure. I'm not a public health desk expert, but I think the hope was that if we had a certain amount of population vaccinated, that we would have two things would happen. One, we would be able to offer those people vaccinated a significant level of protection. I think that's very, very true. Nearly all our patients in ICU are unvaccinated at the moment. So that concept of offering a huge amount of protection has happened from the vaccine. What doesn't seem to have happened to that same level is the reduction in transmission. So we seem to be able to protect people. This vaccine doesn't seem to have the same level of effectiveness in reducing virus transmission in the community. So therefore, it is circulating much higher than we thought we would be with such a high level of vaccination in the community. And there's a lot of people who are still unvaccinated. There's somewhere between 250,000 people still unvaccinated and who are at the exact same risk and the exact same vulnerability levels as they were in March 2020. So, a lot of things have changed, but that problem with transmission hasn't changed. That's a concern, because unfortunately, we know the only way that we've been able to reduce transmission in the past has been increasing social distancing, increasing those measures, which no one wants to go back to.
Yeah, and it was interesting, Dr. Killian de Gascoigne tweeting over the past number of days that when it comes to transmission, vaccinated people can transmit the infection at the exact same viral load as an unvaccinated person, which I thought was very interesting and surprising to me.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I think what it does is offers, and I can't overemphasize that the level of protection it offers the vast majority of people is huge. As I said, we have 9 people in our unit at the moment. 5 are in the intensive care, per se, and 4 in the HDU. But the 5 in the intensive care who are the sickest, none of those have been vaccinated. So the protection level is extraordinary, and it's extremely valuable. But yes, you're able to, get the virus into your system, into your kind of upper airway tract, and the virus can replicate and it can transmit if you cough or sneeze. And that's becoming more evident. There's a lot of work being done on nasal vaccines, and I think that's going to be very important in the future, that we'll probably get intramuscular and nasal vaccines to help with the transmission element of it. But at the moment, yes, that's becoming a concern. And to me, who I'm not an expert in this area, it appears that is the major flaw so far. A flaw is a strong word, but it's a major downside to the vaccination programs. We're not seeing that reduction in transmission that we would have hoped to have seen.
All right. Well, very good to talk to you this morning, and good luck to you all. Thank you very much, Dr. Coleman O'Loughlin, President of the Intensive Care Society of Ireland.